interviewing Joni McKeag on today's date is...
19th.
19th. You can see this is a very informal...
That's wonderful.
Kind of a private procedure, and ongoing, can stop and start at any time. And so we want to know some of your feelings and memories and history of Slippery Rock. Where are you starting, where you wish?
Well, I'd probably start in 1963. That was the date that many Slippery Rock faculty were hired that particular year, including myself and Joyce Murray. And probably the thing that I remember the most about that first year was the camaraderie among the faculty. Our particular departments of health, physical education, and recreation were under a dean at that time. The man's name was Dr. Nettleton. His right-hand person was Martha Haverstick. And those two, in that first year, it will always be prominent in my mind as to the kinds of things that were accomplished and the cooperation that existed among the three departments. And that perhaps is the one thing that was my yardstick for measuring anything that ever happened after that. And consequently, there were many positive things, but it was also a disappointment to me to see how the camaraderie over the years could and indeed in some instances was placated and destroyed by people. That's by us. The camaraderie among the faculty, I would say, was not just within our department, it was everybody. And names that come to mind because they came around that same time was Rhoda Taylor and Irv Kaur, Tony Pagano. Those are people outside my department, but yet faculty knew each other. And I know that that has to do with size in some instances. But during the 60s was also the beginning of the faculty council, a forum where once a month we met in, let me see, I should remember where the first meeting was. I believe it was World Cultures Auditorium. And it was where issues were brought forward. Faculty elected their president and vice president and secretary and vice secretary. This is before union. And there were some very good arguments. But the other thing that I think is important to remember is an attitude where you could argue with your colleagues, but it was, and on some, you know, important points concerning curriculum, for instance, and what was fair. But again, and you have to remember, I am an optimist and I only remember mostly positive things. The bottom line was, what was in the best interest of the students that were going to graduate from Slippery Rock? And one of the most argumentative people, but the one that made you think a lot, was Norm Hawkins. And I don't know if you remember him at all, but he was a gem. There are other adjectives that would fit him better, I'm sure, than calling him a gem, but yet he made you think. And that perhaps was the key. Those particular years, and maybe we were a microcosm of the macrocosm of the kinds of things that were happening in the 60s, which was kind of an opening, you know, from that closed society and a lot of control and everything, it was just kind of opening up. And as the years went on, I think that, you know, that was the, I knew that the kinds of things that could be accomplished by the total faculty and still have no vindictiveness, I knew that that time frame existed. I mean, that the people and the faculty did get along, even though, and you could disagree at a very high level and still accomplish that for which you were hired at Slippery Rock State College, I think at that, it still was a state college at that time. So, and as I say, as the years went on, things change, which they always do, some for the better, without a doubt, as far as the students were concerned. Better education. But in the meantime, you lose. We also, I think, lost some very valuable experiences that of the openness among the faculty and the camaraderie.
And then size changed all that gradually?
Plus the change, I think, in the attitude of the whole, I don't want to say country, but the whole scene. I mean, people began to change. Not just here at Slippery Rock, but everywhere. The value system was changing, and that had an impact. I'm not sure if we had anything to do with that.
But morale was very.
Morale had been
kind of everybody knew everybody, and
yes,
the association was constant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And oftentimes that went beyond school because you felt you were friends at school, and therefore you could be. You were friends outside, and the only thing in Slippery Rock, the only kind of social life that you could create was what you did yourself. Because there certainly weren't, you know, places and things to go unless you went to Pittsburgh or to Newcastle, which again we did but oftentimes we did that in groups, as I recall. No, we used to go to Newcastle with various faculty members would go to that place, it was called the Branding Iron, and have supper and talk, and it was very nice. I know you're not supposed to think of the past as being better, but there were certain aspects of the past that I think that
well,
were better.
It may not be so fashionable, but it may be more, maybe fairly accurate.
Yes.
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 For many of us, there was a good old days, you know, that were better than these new old days, or
yes.
Whatever. Sure. You were pre-Carter. Carter came about year two.
Weisenfluh was, and what might be interesting about President Weisenfluh, because we still, when Joyce and I and some of the others get together, remember his lecture up in the hut, which is now the art building. And I'm going to remember, there were two very important points, and I remember the one that the president, being the president of the college at that time, and all new faculty were sitting in there, and he was giving us the rules of the conditions by which you were hired here at Slippery Rock as a faculty member, but some of the things that you should remember. And one was to open up an account at the local bank and always pay your bills. That was a top priority. And he talked a lot about what you could never say now to a faculty, which was, you know, your behavior and the expectations in this community. And I wish I could be more specific about that, but
he was the father.
Yes, an absolute father image. Of course, I had had him as a ethics teacher here because I am a graduate of Slippery Rock in 1955, and he was a very revered faculty member, Dr. Weisenfluh, revered and feared, but a balance. And no one took his class and was able to be non-communicative. He probably had teaching techniques that years later someone thought they discovered.
Small group stuff.
Right.
And,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So,
was it a required class, or did you?
Ethics was a required class for
everyone?
Every, that's when I was here, when it was a teacher's college, and mm-hmm. you either had Dr. Weisenfluh and the other gentleman, Dr. Wrigley, was the other philosophy teacher. And the two of them were right. They were just revered faculty members. And it really didn't make any difference which one of those teachers that you got, because as I recall, anyhow, that one wasn't, you know, any better than the other. But so when I came back, then Dr. Weisenfluh was the president. Now, a year after, or maybe it was two, and I'm not sure of the dates, but Dr. Weisenfluh found out that he did not have a position, and he was no longer president of Slippery Rock when he was on vacation with his wife in Florida. He got a letter saying,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's how the things could be done.
From Judge Keister.
I believe so.
Yeah.
Yeah, at that time.
Yeah.
Well, as I say, there are people here on the campus who can give you, who are much closer to that situation.
Now, Weisenfluh's philosophy orientation was heavily tilted toward religion.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
Very much so.
It's been mentioned that he expected people to go to church. And
yeah, those kinds of things. Yeah. Paying your bills, and maybe that was it, go to church. He went right down the line as to what kind of
dress code
behaviors. Yes, I think so. But being in physical education, see, the dress code sometimes, would deviate because you had uniforms of sorts that you had to wear. And I think, speaking of the uniforms, that was kilts were worn by physical education majors and by many of the faculty members. And I remember one time I had, one of my favorite kilts was red, and I could not sew very well, and I always sent my things out to be hemmed and everything. And Dr. Haverstick said that one day when she saw me going down the hall in my red kilt, "Joni, don't you think that's a little short?" You could cut some of this out because it's kind of personal. And there was over the campus, I think that there was a certain dress code even for the students going into the dining halls. We won't go back to the 50s because that was in loco parentis. There were...
Well, maybe later on we will go back.
As a student, because you wouldn't... You might remember some of those things from your own college.
Could I... in the 50s, were there many women teachers on the campus at all?
No.
No. So there was an evolution that you saw from the 50s, 60s, 70s,
yes,
and 80s.
Absolutely.
Of the woman's role at this institution.
Exactly.
Yeah. Called progress.
Well, again, you can talk about, the need for the role models and so forth, but when you think about the 50s, that was still very much separated into man, woman, father, like you had mentioned, the father image with the president. And in the 50s, I think my particular generation was not a questioning generation in the early 50s, but things began to happen after that.
There were women administrators, I think.
Dean Harner was the only woman administrator, and the registrar, of course,
yeah.
Marie McKay. Now, I can't think
but not
of...
not classroom.
Not many. There was Miss Cushman in speech and communication. Wonderful lady. Old school, had very high expectations as a teacher. And then I got to know her when I came back to teach her, then as a personal friend. I'm trying to think. Well,
why?
We can look at
what made you pick Slippery Rock as a student? Why did you come here?
I came to a graduation at Slippery Rock when I was a junior in high school. Some close friends of my family, and I can't remember for what reason, but their daughter Burl was a student here graduating, and I had known her, you know, growing up. She was 2 years older than I, but I came here to a graduation, and there was a feeling on the campus then, very much what I'm sure other people have said to you, and the friendliness was very, very open. You could not truly walk anywhere on the small campus, and it was a genuine thing with the hello tradition at Slippery Rock. And I can remember coming up for my interview, and I parked in the circle, and I had to go for a personal interview with Dr. Dean Duncan to see if I would be accepted. But again, remember, that was like, what, probably 900 to 1,000 students. How many of those would be freshmen coming in? So they met personally with every student that was going to be admitted.
Well, that was Bob Duncan?
No, that was...
another Duncan.
Yes. Just slipped me.
Dean
mind.
Duncan?
We call him, he was a dean, dean of instruction.
Oh, okay.
Lawrence, I think it was. Oh. But I don't know.
We can look
that.
Him up.
Yes. And that was one, and to be very honest with you, it was, I had considered just living at home and going to Pitt, and financially it was less expensive to come room and board at Slippery Rock than it was to go back and forth and commute to Pitt at that time, credit-wise. And I think their credits at Pitt were $12.50, as I recall, a credit. I think that's what it was. That's changed. But then I, you know, came to... Plus, Slippery Rock's reputation as a teacher institution was very, very good, as was Indiana's, in proximity to the Pittsburgh area.
So between 55 and 63,
yes.
You had other positions and did
yes.
graduate work and all that stuff?
Exactly, at
yes.
Pitt.
At Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
And then how did you happen to get the teaching position here?
at our state conventions, health, physical education, and recreation state conventions, and just talking with people, I found out that the dance position was opening. Maureen Winters was the dance teacher here, and her husband was, as I remember, a physical education teacher. They were from Utah, I believe. And he had been trying to make the Pittsburgh Steelers football team for 3 or 4 years and was cut at the last minute every time, and they decided to go, that he would give that up. But he had his degree too. Maureen Winters, very well thought of woman. And I found out at the convention that there was an opening, and had a talk with Dr. Haverstick at the state convention, met her, and then came out and interviewed with Dr. Nettleton and several other people that were on staff. And then I did not, that was not a goal. I had no idea that I would ever come to Slippery Rock to teach, but I was at East Stroudsburg. I had 3 years of teaching at East Stroudsburg, 60 to 63, so.
And you got your master's?
At Pitt.
Right away.
In those days, you had to get permanently certified in teacher education, you had to have 6 hours above your bachelor's. And so I went Pitt Night School, started, and then I did go a summer to Colorado and transferred credits back to Pitt and finished there in 62, I think it was. So, but there again, you know, in the state of Pennsylvania, Slippery Rock has always had at that time, I mean, their reputation was excellent. And to come back here and teach was a, you know, an honor, a guess you could say that, in those days again, when you think about to become a college teacher was unreal. And ironically, I had taught 5 years in public school in Penn Hills, outside of Pittsburgh, and one of my former teachers, John Eiler, here at Slippery Rock, I met at a state convention that was held in Pittsburgh, and I had not seen him for about 4 years or so. And he came over and said, "Joni, do you think you would ever be interested in teaching at the college level?" I said, "Well, I hadn't thought about that, Mr. Otter, but that's how I got my position, basically, at East Stroudsburg." But then, as I say, I saw Maureen at the state convention, and she said, "Joni, why don't you apply it at Slippery Rock?" And so I did, and stayed for 26 or so years, I guess.
So dance was your specialty at that time?
I had taken dance classes at Colorado and then at Pitt. But in those days, again, a specialty was not like a specialty is today. So many courses, you know, would give you a specialty. But in the meantime, you had to take other kinds of things. But dance was, when I began teaching in the public schools, and at that time there were not a lot of sports for women, more on an intramural basis. In fact, I wrote papers about that too. I wrote a major paper at Pitt against competition for women, that they should not. Yes. And of course that's changed a little over the years, because the information at that time was incorrect. The research that had been done saying
it's going to do physiologically.
Oh, physiologically, it was absolutely. I mean, you could go to a library and just have doctor after doctor telling you that this was in
bad stuff.
Bad stuff.
Then the Carter came right after you did.
There was an interim. We've had several interims, as I recall. Dr. Edwards was an interim president between, but yes, Dr. Carter came, and
so there was a variation from president to president in terms of how it affected everything in your program. And sometimes your programs got a lot of support, and then sometimes they didn't get very much support. Sometimes the women's programs got nothing, and sometimes they were getting along very well.
Exactly.
So
it fluctuated depending on the attitude and the thinking of the person that was in the leadership position. But you know, now see, in my thinking, and I could be in error, but I, even with the father image, there still seemed to be a little more fairness early on than later. It became problematic later. You know, they made it, my recollection of it is that it was made divisive, so that people were pitted, began to be pitted against one another for monies, for time, for space. And consequently, then you did have what I call battles. And but that had to be, I think. I mean, even from the state level, you know, on down, that during that time frame, the hiring of women, as you mentioned, it was a change. I was, for instance, I saw some information as I don't think they call it a sponsor, but I worked with student government. And the student government president would get a printout on, for instance, merit raises. And at that time, that had to be before the union because it was not public knowledge who received merit raises. Now, why the president of student council would have access to that, I do not know. But I can remember going to a meeting, and let me think if I can remember, that the young man that was the student government president has been back on campus. He is a lawyer. He was outstanding at one of the, he received the Outstanding Alumni Award. And I'm not going to remember his name, and that's because he was a bright, marvelous young man that we could, he had personal friends with Bobby Watson. And he had, I know that he's received that award. I believe he's in Arizona. Sally Lennox would know him immediately. But anyhow, I can, he said, Miss McKay, why don't you take a look at this, and handed me the paper, and I was going down through it, and had shock tremors go through me saying, what? Her? Him?
Promotion list did the same thing.
Exactly, you know, I'm sure, you know, before, well, again, you know, there is like before the union and and then after. The faculty, let me get back, and I know I'm jumping back and forth, but I still think that what would be important, and I think if you, like with a Tony Pagano and with Rhoda Taylor, as they would remember the very beginnings, there was another, Bob Stackhouse was also involved in that group for a while, but with the faculty council, when
Stackman.
It, Stackman, that's it. And meeting for hours in preparation for the, you know, for the meetings and what the agenda, you know, was going to be. And Rhoda Taylor was elected the vice president, I believe. Who was the first president? Tony Pagano.
Look it up.
All right. That might be interesting. I was an officer.
So there wasn't a faculty organization before that?
I think the faculty organization before that was controlled by the administration. And the, as it was evolving, the faculty council was, and there were, like the administration was then invited to the faculty council rather than the control always coming from. It was the beginning of a different kind of thinking where faculty did indeed want to have a little more control over. I'll bet that the major thing was curriculum. That's what's run, that runs in my mind. Rather than having a few people making those decisions that more faculty wanted to have their input, and there basically wasn't that kind of a forum where you just had to be stand up and be recognized and say what you thought about something.
I think Martha said at one time that when the schedule was set, that all of the men coaches and so forth all got their pick of times.
Yes.
And women were plumb second.
Right.
Yes.
She would know that because she was working at that time whenever I first came here, as I said, she and Dr. Nettleton worked hand in glove that first year in trying to make the schedules a little more fair. But then he left after that first year, and that also then was a change. That might be a little too. There's some things that I probably would have to talk about without the without recording it, and then make a determination whether or not it should be on.
Well, you have the you know, when you get your tape back, this transcript, then you're the editor.
Yeah. And well, your point is well taken because that's exactly what would happen. The women then. And let me, Dr. Haverstick was and remains a leader. She is a person who has the facts, does not go in like I might and attack a problem emotionally first and then think about it. She would have thought everything and did, indeed. As time went on, there was almost like a, the women almost had to rally in order to get something done that indeed was fair. And again, my comparison is that I didn't think that that had to happen at first, but that as time went on, it became more of a battle. You know, how can you do this? Like the girls in sports, as far as that is concerned, would practice, what, at 10 o'clock at night or something to that effect, because that was the only time it was available in the West Gym or something like that. But there are others who can tell you about the, you know, the coaching and things like that. But even so, it was, I had the dance group, or cases, and that was a battle. I had a dance show with 125 students in it, because I had no cots, because that's what Orchesis was. Performance was not, you know, as great as it is today, which is, you know, wonderful. But it had a different, again, it was more intramural, that if you wanted to be in the dance show, you could, as long as you came to practice and, you know, and, but that was, the budget for Orchesis might have been, when I first started, I think it was $25.
All that.
Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of inequities as to who indeed did get the monies. But you see, that wasn't so different than what was going on everywhere else at that point in time, you see. But then that made an imperative that you had to begin to speak up and say things, whereas I'm going to refer back to the 50s, where it was, you were told what to do, you just go ahead and do it. And don't say anything about it. Well, that I think all began to change, and then you had to suffer along. When any group, whether it's women, blacks, white, red, whatever that happens to be, whenever you begin to speak up, you must be prepared for the counterattack of untruths. Name calling of all kinds going on because you were trying to do what you believed in or what you thought was right. My thought is always, though, in all our conversations and everything, is that the unfairness was basically, it was to some of the faculty, both men and women, but it was the students who were not being treated fairly when you came right down to it. And so over time, that, as you well know, that has changed.
So you started to wage this war before Title IX?
Yes. Oh, yes. Always. And didn't think along in the terms of a legislation being passed, because it was, you know, years prior to that, where you were still trying to get something that was, if there is such a word as fair, I'm not sure that that's the right word, but, you know, I can tell you that the girls would get the gymnasium when I was a student for 3 hours a week on a Wednesday. That was it. 7 to 10. And that's the only time you were allowed to use the gymnasiums at night. Now that was just the East and West Gym at that time, but that kind of carried over even in the 60s. Where all the practice times would be. signed up first by the men coaches and then the girls. But, you know, that's... That had to be talked about and become an issue before some equity was achieved.
You were teaching roughly 15 hours and then had extracurricular obligations?
Oh, yes.
Your days were very long.
Very long.
That's what I
hear. Yes.
And sometimes the weekends as well, I suppose.
Oh, you never even thought about that. See, we had Saturday classes till noon also. I had many 8 o'clock Saturday classes, many, for those years.
When the collective, when we did get the union in 72 or whenever it was, it was just a year or so after I got here, were there breakthroughs for women in that first collective bargaining agreement in terms of equity and course loads and the distribution of this, that, and the other?
I would have to really look at that. It's my feeling that...
Coaches, they started defining coaches, and they started defining extracurricular part of your regular load. A lot of things were in that first one that Marty Moran did.
Yes. That's him.
And it must have made the, I'm not sure I like the, they made the playing field a little more level.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because now you had an instrument. I mean, you had a group that was organized that you could go to and grieve. But I was an anti-union person, mainly because of my childhood. I mean, coming up through and the things that I saw, you know. But as you gather the facts and as you live through it, like in the 60s, and you saw that you did not have any power, that you had to have another way of expressing yourselves as a group, and then you had to have a vehicle through which you had power. And the union, basically. I remember this because Marie Wheaton was also, like, we were saying, how can we vote for a union? And we were saying, how can we not? You know, it was like going against what our fathers or our uncles or anybody had said. You know, you don't want to be a teamster.
Oh,
you don't want to be a teamster. You don't want to be. But and it did cause some interesting conversations at home when you went back to visit. But here again, the union then opened things up, and indeed, in the very beginning, made things a better playing field, as you alluded to. I don't like the fact that we needed it. You see, I'm still a very idealistic person that I think when intelligent groups, or maybe not even intelligent groups of people, but if you can sit down and you communicate that this struggle over the power is a demise of us, that you cannot come up with an intelligent solutions to problems without having to go through the power struggle.
When they had the uprising against Carter, the faculty meetings and the student the mini revolt and all
exactly.
that.
Exactly, marching around.
You were here.
Yes.
And did you have a role in all that?
I was in it.
Yeah.
I remember all the faculty or those who wanted to. The board meeting was in the field house, and Mrs. Vincent was on the board, and Emma Guffey Miller. At that time, she was getting quite hard of hearing. I'm trying to remember who the representatives were that went in that day as we stood in the lobby of the field house. And the remark, it may have been Tony Pagano. There was a representative in the conference room at that particular point in time. And supposedly Emma Guffey Miller, because she was hard of hearing, turned to Mrs. Vincent and said, "What are all these people doing here?" It was, you know, a comic scene in a sense. But it did show that the faculty, that, well, what we can, the word now is solidarity. That's what it was. I had a former professor who was in the administration when I came back to teach here, come to my office and try to dissuade me from voting for the union. Now, he said it was for my own good, but there again, you would go back to the father image, because this professor also was highly regarded economics professor here on the campus, and just, and good. But he was in the administration, and I'll never, I was sitting in my office, and he knocked on the door and came in and sat down and was like a father figure. Now, Joni, this is something that you do not want to do. It will follow you. It will hurt you for the rest of your life. But I'm not quite so sure that he didn't say, now, do I have your promise? And I had to look at him and say, no, you don't. I couldn't lie to him.
You were in the AAUP before that?
Mm-hmm.
AAUP?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Well, that was one of our options when we voted originally, AAUP.
And that was one of the options.
Yes, exactly. What did you like most about the years at Slippery Rock? I mean, what were your greatest satisfactions?
Well, my greatest satisfaction has always been the students. And I don't say that lightly. But an openness, the kinds of students, the variety of students that I have had, I guess, as far as intellect and culture, and you know, Slippery Rock does not get one particular kind of a student, because it is a state school. I think you get a broad spectrum of young people with various backgrounds, and I think listening and has given me a better hold on, has given me a more global look, or perhaps I could use that term. That there was much to learn from the students if you were willing to give the time. And in my kind of personality, what was good for me, which was to have an open door policy no matter what, when the black issues began, when the Vietnam issues were there, I wanted to hear. You know, I really craved wanting to know all sides and all aspects of what the students thought about those particular issues. So I think I was able. I learned a lot. It just opened up a greater understanding than some of my friends. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong, because some people just choose not. They don't want to know, you know. It's not that important for them, but for me, it always was.
You mentioned Dr. Haverstick as somebody important, and is she the main figure you look back on, or are there others?
There are others, but I would say that she was probably the role model that would be nearest, and I don't, I'm going to say, the nearest is a professional role model than I could think of would be Dr. Haverstick. She was a person that, for instance, on an evaluation team, when she would come in to evaluate any, she has an insight about her as far as teaching that was concerned, that she could look at the class and look at the professor and just know what learning was taking place or maybe wasn't. But she could write it in such a way, I still have mine somewhere, one that I kept, because it was specifically the positive aspects of a particular class, and then improvement. You know, it wasn't a form that they use now, or had used before I left. And it was just a written evaluation. And then she made you think about these things. Might this have happened if you had done that? Could you have done this? And it was like, yeah, that's right.
Sure.
Oh, boy, I just.
Sure, well, that's a lovely critique. When the person is able to help you explore other options.
Exactly,
you know,
exactly. See, that's,
conduct your class.
Well, she has that talent. She had it, and I'm, you know, she has a lot of talents. She's mm-hmm. courageous, she's everything.
Unfailingly honest.
Oh, without a doubt. There was a time, and that's what I'm not sure about it as far as the tape is concerned, but there, Dr. Haverstick, I feel at one time was attacked professionally by group of people on the campus, and her honesty and her integrity was so strong that the people who tried to destroy her, this is always my example, never won an election on this campus when they ran for anything, whether it was dealing with faculty council or afterward voting in the union. I don't think Martha Haverstick has ever lost an office that she has put her name in for, well, any committee. And some of the faculty members that you could talk to, they didn't come to me because that would have brought out my fighting instinct, which I'm really a pacifist, but don't.
Was the issue a personality, or was there something substantive about it?
I think the issue was power, and the fact that Martha was respected so much, and she was honest, she was fair. She had the attributes that other people would probably wish that you had them as consistently as she did. And it was both a personal and a professional attack. And there were certain things that I know other people would not. We have talked about it, but it was as if I could get you to say something derogatory about her, you, see, then I could take that and use it over here saying that you said it. Although I wanted you to say it, and I would keep asking you questions until something would come out, and then I could use it. But you see, it didn't work. It did not. And she stayed forthright, and I think the department as such almost chased her out, and I am intentionally not naming names at this point in time, but that's when she did. I mean, other people in the other departments, then she chose to, if she could not be the leader officially in our department, then she went out, and all these other people began to know Martha Haverstick better, which was, in a sense, almost a good thing, because mm-hmm. then as she worked on other committees outside our own department, then people began to know how intelligent, fair, honest. Isn't that mm-hmm. truly? I mean,
that's
people
right.
that work with her, you just, you know.
That's right.
And that, in my mind, was probably the best thing that could have happened to Dr. Haverstick at that.
Widened her influence.
Oh, my, yes.
All over campus.
And her input, you see, on those committees.
And she was the backbone of every committee that she ever served on. That's right.
And continued to still be the model for someone like me, you see, to applaud and look up to. There are other people that I must, one of my greatest experiences at Slippery Rock was the beginning when I came back from Purdue after 4 years of working on that PhD. It is sometimes after you finish working, you know, on a degree, there is a void. And something wonderful happened, and I've joked about it with Gary Quast as being the token woman, but freshman studies. The beginning of freshman studies. And I came back after Larry Cobb, Gary, Bob,
McCoskey.
And I think those were the three key people, and then Carl Dresden and myself. And we joked about it. I did not know Larry Cobb. I did not really know, and I did not really know Bob McCoskey. I knew Carl. But that was one of the most intellectually stimulating. No, that was the most intellectually stimulating experience that I've had at Slippery Rock.
And how long did you stay with that group?
4 or 5 years. I can think about Bob McCoskey after we did get to know each other. When he didn't say this to me, then later on we could joke about it. But when my name was suggested by Gary Quast, he and I had worked together and knew each other personally. And when they were saying, "Well, we probably ought to get a female on this somehow," and he said, you know, Joni McKagan, McCoskey said, "A jock." Now, the ending to that, of course, is the fact that I love Bob McCoskey, and he loved me, and the love that is the agape love. And when I was going for a promotion and having a very difficult time getting a promotion, his letter is... he tells that story in the letter to the committee that he wrote after it was turned down 3 times. So that's, you know, that's all right too. But Bob's letter then on the growth and the interchange of ideas. So then I had said to Bob, "Well, I must be honest with you, the one of the words that I thought about in the first couple of our meetings, I thought, boy, this guy's a buffoon." And he just roared when I told him that. And far from it. Far from it. Marvelous man. But that experience then, and then others came into the program, but the hours and hours of planning and preparation and reading. Oh, that's when I first read Gandhi's Truth, and, you know, some things that I just would not have. I know I wouldn't have gotten to it, you know, but you know, those little things that we would say, well, you should read this, or you should read this, and then we'd share the books and everything in preparation to enlighten our own minds, let alone trying to enlighten the minds of 100 and some students. So, but that probably was the highlight of my years, academically speaking, and really from a personal viewpoint. And the first years of the dance shows, the students, and how hard they worked. And it didn't make any difference that the budget wasn't there. We did it anyhow, and I'm not quite sure how, and so many times. There was a fellow by the name of, we needed some paint to finish a set before that show, and up in the theater, I had arguments at first with Milt Carlos, because he was the theater. And he wasn't very good at first in sharing the stage and the theater. And then there again, the relationship that grew from Milt and Blaise Scarnati and myself was another family experience. And again, here's three different people from three different departments working together. And what's the bottom line? The students. You see, well, I think that's like in freshman studies. When you set your priorities, good things happen. And what is a university? Because we're not a research university. I mean, that is not one of our major goals because we don't have the finances. Not to say, it does go on. It does go on. But we're not, you know, the University of Pittsburgh or IU or Purdue and, you know, that. But when the priorities are put in order, and that is to cause some kind of a change in those human beings that come here, whether they're young or old now, and causing learning. And then if you learn, then you can cause change, and change in behavior and change in some of the things that are going on. But
did you travel with athletic? Did you coach and travel?
No, I did not. See, I was the coach of dance. That was the major. And I had had some experiences in coaching in public school, which were, at that time, very terrible because it was, if you wanted to coach, you could. And you would have, that was the late hours because you couldn't get into the gym until all the boys were finished and there were no uniforms or anything, so the girls had to buy their own Bermudas. So I had already gone through that in public school, and it was a battle that was not going to be won at that time. The timing was not right. And whereas, again, in the 60s, as things began to happen, you began to make it right. But then I still have a problem with competition. I believe, you know, there is always going to be that, the element, but I'm not real good with the emphasis. And I wouldn't want to start on what I think of Little League and all those things because I don't believe in it. But I know why I do. I taught a course in children in sport and looked at tons and tons of research that nobody looks at. So, but we're reaping. Well, you're reaping it. You reap it. What you do with little children when you organize their thinking and their thoughts.
High school burnout's a big problem, you know. These kids.
Life burnout.
Later, I see. Right.
You know.
Yeah, the whole concept that there are winners and losers, you know. Numero uno.
No, I'm number one. No. Well, what happens to the other? You know,
the other 4.5 million.
I just heard they almost poo-pawed the fact with this advertisement for the Visa card or something on the radio when you go to the Olympics in Barcelona. It's like, if you don't win the gold, then, you know, what is the silver?
Who are you?
Who are you? Oh, that's ludicrous. Ludicrous.
Yes.
But
so destructive.
Well, that's what we've done. So we've taken the concept of competition and we've destroyed it. And it's amazing. But I would have, you know, my druthers would be all that parking space that you have for all the athletic events, all that millions of dollars that you put into tar and lines and things like that. I just have it all filled. Anybody wanted to play, come on and play. I'm sorry, but that's... And that's how I felt about the Yorkeses, and that's why so many people were in the dance show. But that too was such an enjoyable experience for me. And that's when Miss Cushman did the oral narration and for the shows, and we would come up with all different kinds of ideas. Lillian Hasko was here then. Did either one of you ever had Lillian? Lillian was one of our outstanding students. Dancer, physical educator, human being.
Yes, I know the name.
Dr. Hasko now, she's finished her degree and she's a doctor of philosophy and was working on a program that had been funded by the government, music, art, and physical education in the elementary schools in Virginia, close to Washington, D.C. But those funds were taken away, and now Lillian is a physical education teacher with her doctorate degree from Washington University, I believe, teaching elementary physical education. But I haven't talked with Lillian lately, but I'm sure that they're still doing the kinds of things on their own. She's a... I'm not sure that I'm adding anything to what other people probably have
Yes, you are.
Have mentioned.
You're adding some important emphasis. It's unique, and it's exactly the kind of things we want to save.
Well, it is perception, isn't it? I mean, it's and we all have our our own filtering systems.
So were there particular departments? Of course, we were a school of physical education and a school of education. Those are the big ones until way into the 70s,
yes.
I suspect.
Yes.
But there were some small departments that were pretty good.
Yes. The English department had a fine reputation. I wouldn't want to slight anybody, but I'm not quite so sure, and I know I'm probably being naive about this as I look back on it. I do not believe that there was basically a poor department when you consider the people that were in that department did the best they could under the circumstances and under what they had to work with. Do you know what I mean? It was like when you went into the science department, and again, of course, this man had retired before I came back, but even then, Carl Dresden, but he was young, he's still here, went on and got Kearney. That's terrible. The one that just committed suicide.
Oh, Murph Shelgren.
Murph Shelgren. I mean, you know, when you think, see, a lot of those people were here, like we were kind of all young together. Well, they were Ray Biswanger, Bobby Duncan. I mean, when you say names of people, well, I'll tell you someone. Charlie Halt was still here. He hadn't retired. He was in the history department. Whoa. In fact, I think he left Slippery Rock as chairman of the history department, went down to West Virginia and taught another 10 years or was chair down there. I don't know what's happened to him, and he was my teacher.
Charlie Halt.
Halt. Dr. Charles Halt.
Nice.
And he was here a good many years.
Was he still here in 63 when you came?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There were still quite a few of the faculty. Dr. Spotts had retired before I came back. I can almost go to the buildings because they were, and again, Miss Harner, I'm sure, you know, she was still here. And what a change that woman had to live through from being the Dean of Women and having that, if you want to talk about power, now she had the power of North Hall. I can tell you that.
Did you live there?
Yes. Indeed. A marvelous lady. And I think that